Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network and Anthropology podcast, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host of the channel. Today, we're talking to Dr. Ashante Reese about her book, Black Food Geographies, Race, Self-Reliance, and Food Access in Washington, D.C. Dr. Reese is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. So Ashante Reese, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So can we begin the interview by you just telling us a little bit about yourself, if you could talk about your background, your training, how you came to write the book, how you became interested in this topic?
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in East Texas. And by small, I mean about 7,000 people. Every time I say small town, people are thinking like, oh, 100,000 people. No, like an actual town. And I went to undergrad at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. And San Antonio was a really pivotal experience for me because having grown up in a small town, it was the first time I was living in a city and I was entirely fascinated by cities. And then also living in San Antonio is where I realized that the ways people are organized in cities matters, and the way cities are organized can either improve one's quality of life or not. And so after undergrad, I taught middle school for a couple years, and that was another pivotal experience because that's what actually landed me with thinking about food, because I had taught middle school. And I talk a little bit about this in the book, but an experience with two of my students really made me stop and think about food access in a way that I had not thought about before. And so when I decided I was going to go to graduate school and I was going to study anthropology, I basically picked up these questions that students had asked me that I couldn't answer and decided that that's what I wanted to understand more. I wanted to understand more about the built environment, how that impacts food access. At the time, I was really, really interested in how it impacted youth. And of course, that shifted a bit, as you see in the book. But ultimately, like what I can now name is that I was interested in the connections between cities and Black life. And I happened to use food as the way for me to think about that. So at American, I entered anthropology. At the time, there was a concentration on race, gender, and social justice, which is what attracted me there. And I went to graduate school because I wanted to learn, I wanted to read, I wanted to write. I had not landed that I wanted to be a professor or work in a university setting, and actually, honestly, had not landed that for myself until I got my first job. But I was mentored and am still mentored by Rachel Watkins, Michael Bader, who's a sociologist, and Psyche Williams-Forston. They all had their own unique influences on how I came to write what I write and what I wrote in the book. But most of all, I think those three people encouraged me to think about writing as a process and not just the product. So Rachel would always say to me, rigor is a process. And I love that because it helped me think about, okay, I'm not just producing a dissertation. And then subsequently, I'm not just producing a book. Like, how can I do justice to a topic that I really care about? So that's like a brief kind of introduction to my background.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So the text, the book, Black Food Geographies, it's a very rich ethnographic account of the ways in which African Americans access food in an area commonly referred to as a food desert, right? And so, you know, the term food desert, of course, it's popularly used to describe an area that appears to have few options or locations to purchase food. But your book is really a powerful critique. I think it really, that's, you know, part of the doing justice, part of the, you know, idea of the doing justice that you talk about, is this critique of the idea of a food desert. And so I was just going to, wanted to just begin by having you just talk about just the general problems with this term, and other terms that are more maybe holistic or critical that really talk about the problem of food access in urban communities.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for asking that. So one of the things that I want to start off by saying is that, you know, terms change, they shift, language changes, meanings change, and also our understanding of these terms change. So when I first came into studying food access, I was like most people and hadn't really thought about what the term food desert might imply. And there were a few things that helped shift my understanding of this. One, I want to give a shout out to LaDonna Redman, who's been doing work around food activism for a very long time. And she has a TED Talk that's called Food Justice 2.0. And I watched it fairly early and was really, it was really helpful. LaDonna, at that point, you know, there was all this stuff that was happening. Food was on the radar. There was healthy food initiatives coming up all over the place. And LaDonna's TED Talk really brings us back to thinking about structurally and foundationally, what are we actually trying to get at? What is the root of the inequity? And in that TED Talk, she talks about the connections to enslavement, racial segregation, and all of that. So that was happening on one front. I was also being mentored and influenced by, I already mentioned Michael Bader, he's a sociologist, but he was doing work on the built environment, racial segregation, these things. And I was doing work at Johns Hopkins at the Center for Health Disparity Solutions. So all of these different things were happening at the same time. Not to mention that once I got into the field, what people were saying about their experiences didn't match up with these measures of so-called food desert. So there had been activist work like LaDonna. There was also kind of scholar activist work like Nia Jones and Food for Black Thought. All of these different things were happening around the same time. And so when I started field work, people had strong critiques of their neighborhood, right? But what differed from how we see food desert operates popularly is A, like their critiques, a lot of the critiques were rooted in the idea of structural racism. When you look at food desert definitions broadly, most of them do not include measures of race, including if we look at the ERS data and the quote unquote food desert maps, there are overlays for income, there are overlays for car access, there are overlays for where stores are, and no overlays for race. And I think that's intentional, right? Like, to say food desert, we think of a very concrete place and we don't think about the processes that underlie how a place get that way. And for me, I use residential segregation as an avenue to think about that, but people use other ways of looking. And then another thing, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the book, is once a community gets this label, that is almost synonymous with the idea that there is nothing there. And historically, when thinking about Black communities in the U.S. and even beyond the U.S., there's this connection between Blackness and nothingness. And that's something that I think in the book I wanted to disrupt a bit.
Yeah, and then, absolutely. Sorry. And so I wanted to then also take us, because you said the people in the community, I wanted you to just orient us to the community. It was particularly the Deanwood community of Washington, D.C. And so I was going to ask, how did you choose this site? And can you just describe or orient us to the site, to the Deanwood community?
Yeah. So with your first question, how did I choose? It kind of chose me in the sense that I, even up through the start of my dissertation work, kind of honing in on where I was going to do my work, Deanwood wasn't it. I had a plan to do work in an entirely different part of the metro area. But I had been volunteering in Deanwood. When I first started graduate school, I was looking for opportunities to do something meaningful outside of school. And since I had taught middle school before, I was looking for places I can volunteer with children. I love working with kids. And so I called a bunch of community centers, and Deanwood was one. When I called the rec center, they said, "Can you come today?" And I said, "Sure." So I ended up volunteering there, got to know people. And the director of the rec center at the time, a couple of years into my having been there for a while, was asking me about my studies. I was telling him what I was interested in. And he asked me, he said, "Did you ever think about doing your research here?" And I said, "No, I just come over here to volunteer or whatever." And he says, "I think you should do a little bit of research about the history of the neighborhood and see if it's a good fit." And so I did. And what I found immediately was that there's this really interesting history and historical narrative around self-reliance on the one hand, and on the other hand, it is a neighborhood that's located in upper northeast DC. It's a neighborhood that doesn't have a lot of written history. And so both of those things in tandem made it interesting to me to think about how, if I did work on this neighborhood, how that might contribute to more written history about the neighborhood. But also, I was really deeply engaged and interested and curious about this question of self-reliance. And I wanted to know, like, how that showed up and what people were saying. So, like, when I started doing work in Deanwood, I never asked people about self-reliance. But because it's part of the neighborhood's branding, people talked about it quite often. And I wouldn't even say just the neighborhood's branding. I really think that there's this ethos and there's this pride around this idea of self-reliance. So Deanwood, upper northeast D.C., even people who live in D.C., when I would say I was doing research in Deanwood, they'd say, "Where's that?" So that's the kind of, it's not like legible to a lot of people. It's in the book, I write about it as being a place that hadn't been heavily gentrified yet. I think that is still true to a limited extent. Being in Northeast D.C. and upper Northeast D.C., I'm using protection in quotation marks. It protected Deanwood a bit because it's kind of off the beaten path and it's not well connected on public transit. So I started doing work there because it was interesting. Right across, like, one of the boundaries of Deanwood, on the other side is Prince George's County, Maryland. I kind of accidentally ended up being there. And it was probably the best accident of my academic career so far.
That's really interesting. And so in the book, in chapter one, you really like give us this broader context for Deanwood. You place it, you know, you give us this historical context for the neighborhood, and you place it within these historical processes of the conditions of what conditions the decrease in options for purchasing food. And I thought this was so interesting because I've never thought about what are the historical conditions that have, you know, sort of generated these this situation, the problems that you're looking at. And you lay out this really great timeline, which is, I mean, it's complex, right? But you talk about, you know, histories of family gardens and hucksters. Local stores, and then how they're displaced by supermarkets. So I was just wondering if you could talk about that process a little bit, and anything else you want to say about that, and then how the supermarkets leave. And so the question is just about the historical processes that bring about the very, you know, the very problems that you're looking at in the present?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So yesterday in my class, I just taught this article that I really, really love. And it's written by a geographer, Bobby Wilson, and it's called Capital's Need to Sell. And the article is great because there's this overview of this transition from enslavement, from Black people's transition from enslavement, and what that meant for the economy, particularly what that meant for economies that developed in these segregated spaces. So I mention that because Deanwood is basically exactly the kind of place that Bobby Wilson is writing about in this article. So predominantly Black, has been predominantly Black, at least since the 1930s. There has historically been, and even still is, a lot of class diversity in the neighborhood, though the median income is less than the median income of DC. All of that is important because in these earlier formations of neighborhoods, it was not uncommon for there to be several small general stores sprinkled throughout the neighborhood. It also wasn't uncommon for cities to have these larger, like, markets, outdoor markets where you could buy, like, things that you might not have been able to buy regularly in your neighborhood. Think farmers market, but perhaps on a larger scale. And so there's that about food. And what's happening on the outer ring is that we see that, as capitalism does, right? Like, there's this move toward efficiency. There's this move toward technological advances. There's this move toward, like, being able to do more things in shorter time. So we also see refrigeration improving. We see food being able to travel further distances because of improvements in transportation. And this is also the context in which we start to see what we now think of as supermarkets. So supermarkets had this advantage over these smaller mom and pop stores, or what some people call mom and pop stores. Some of those advantages included buying power, being able to buy in bulk for cheaper, being able to hire more people, and being able to have longer hours. So that was a huge shift, because thinking back to this model where I said there were multiple kind of stores and people might shop at the one that was closest to them, as those stores start to no longer be viable, then supermarkets become this mega place where you can get everything that you need in one place. That's all great. But then what might have been 10 stores, and now you have, if you have even any, 2 or 3 stores, that's where we start to see how supermarkets pattern along the lines of race and class in cities. That they're locating in places. And if someone is studying, someone else who's studying supermarkets might also say, yes, but they do this because they're not thinking about race and class. They're thinking about their bottom line. The market is deciding, right? That's a thing that someone might say. But the thing about the market, and this is why I brought up Bobby Wilson's work, is that the market isn't race neutral. Capital's imperative is to bring as many consumers into the market as possible. And then there's this competition for consumers. Something like food is really interesting to think about because everybody needs to eat. So the thing about the study that is true both historically and in the contemporary moment is that people will travel to get the food that they need. And I think that that's a part of, that has become almost a normal everyday experience that really at some point historically wasn't a normal everyday experience. Historically, they're in cities at least. I think rural areas have a little bit of a different geography, but historically in cities, people have often been able to walk to access the food that they need.
And it seems like in the neighborhood, and so you were saying this, that people have to, travel to get what they need. So picking up on that thread, it seems like, what you're emphasizing with this idea of self-reliance is that, residents have to rely on themselves for acquiring food, And they're doing that after, you know, supermarkets, which you talk about in chapter one, after supermarkets have also, in a way, evacuated the city after some, you know, upheavals and you know, protests and tensions in the late 68. And so you talk about this idea of self-reliance as like a theory and a scaffolding for the book. It pulls everything together very well. And you discuss how residents navigate the food scene in their Deanwood community. And in particularly in chapter, you know, two and three, you have these really rich interviews with people where they you know, are talking about how they access food and their ideas of the neighborhood. And so I just want to quote you on page eight. You describe, quote, geographies of self-reliance. And you say that this is, quote, how residents physically navigate the food landscape, where they shop, how they get there, for example, and more phenomenological concerns, memory, nostalgia, personal and communal priorities, hope, engagements with history, and racialized responsibility. So I was wondering if you could just talk about this idea of self-reliance, or how you conceptualize it, and how it emerges, you know, from the interviews with the residents. And it was interesting too that you said that it's sort of part of the ethos of the community as well. That was really interesting.
I think a few things. I think that for Black people in the U.S., and maybe this extends also beyond the U.S., but certainly here, there are ways that even the most hopeful of us tend to be skeptical of whether or not the state is going to be able to fully meet our needs, state or corporate actors, right? And I think that that's part of what comes out in the self-reliance thing, which is a real deep and embodied understanding of how race and racism works in this country. And if racism is working the way that it is intended to, and it always does, or usually does, then there is always going to have to be a plan for like getting your needs met. And I think that that's part of what is true about Deanwood's ethos around self-reliance. The other thing is this neighborhood, just giving a little bit more context. So when Deanwood started to develop as a neighborhood, it's not the center of DC. It's not like Shaw. It's not like LaJoint Park. It's not these places where there was this thriving or considered to be a thriving Black cultural center. For a number of people, Deanwood was just considered like the country and like kind of backwoods, didn't have running, like wasn't tied into the city sewer system for a long time, took a while to get even paved streets. So all of that is important because that is part of where this self-reliance ethos comes from, right? People were gardening, they were farming, you know, there was class integration to some extent within the neighborhood. People were building their own homes, all of that. So in the present moment, when people are talking about self-reliance, they're like theorizing on one hand, but they're also very much pointing to their grandparents, their great-grandparents, their neighbors, whomever that they knew who did these things in the neighborhood. And that's a blessing in some ways. And then it also becomes a very sharp edge of critique, as you see in the book, where people will say, we used to do these things, why aren't we doing it now, right? And then take on full responsibility, right? Which is that's the tension around self-reliance. I acknowledge the ways that the state is going to fail me so we can do these things. But like the then turning around and taking sole responsibility when theoretically the state should have some responsibility in caring for its citizens. So that is part of the self-reliance thing. The other part is there's this really, I kind of write about this more implicitly than explicitly, but there was a really strong current of people wanting to have a community that felt cohesive. There is a strong investment, and for a lot of people, self-reliance or a lack of self-reliance was used as a as the explanation for why the neighborhood didn't feel cohesive. And that's really interesting because that gets into questions around homogeneity and difference and all of these things that I do think kind of come out a little bit in the book, but I didn't write about as explicitly as I maybe could have. Because at heart, these are fundamentally questions around who belongs, who doesn't, what does it mean to belong, what does it mean to create a community where people know each other, or to go back to one of my participants, a community, she wanted a community where she no longer needed to lock her doors like she did when she was a kid. Like, what does it mean for that nostalgia to come into the present and shape our understandings of what we should or should not be doing for the sake of our community? And so self-reliance became this very powerful ethos, yes, but like I think in the book I call it a cultural logic. And now after having written the book, I've been thinking more about metaphor. Like, how does self-reliance show up as metaphor in food spaces and Deanwood and beyond? I don't have an answer to that. It's just something that I've been thinking about. I hope that answered your question. I feel like I rambled a little bit. But.
Oh, no, I think it answered it really well. I mean, I really enjoyed reading people's accounts of, like, how you talk about nostalgia, how people are talking about restaurants that aren't there and markets that aren't there. You know, they're relying on and the gardening and talking about their families. And we'll talk about methods a little bit, but because it just seems like these are things that keep coming up that people continue to reference, you know, without you necessarily having to prompt them. These are like really important things to people. And I have you kind of got into this too. And so I don't know if you would have more to say about this, because I thought when you think about self-reliance, like today, one might think about neoliberalism and the decrease in protections and securities, the receding state, and how we kind of have to rely on ourselves in free market capitalism. But it seemed like your idea of self-reliance is distinct from this. I thought you were giving us like a different spin on self-reliance that's more rooted, that's more complex and like rooted in the lived experiences and histories of African Americans. Like, they might offer us another way to think about self-reliance. And I think you kind of got at this too, if the state isn't going to meet your needs. But I was wondering if you had anything else, if you had anything else to say about that, or if you think about it.
Yeah, no, I think this is a great question. And so one of the things I should say is when I was first writing and trying to make sense of these things that people were saying, of course, in a similar way of what you were saying, I started thinking about neoliberalism. And I have to really credit Psyche Williams-Forson, who really pushed me to think about, are there other ways to conceptualize these thoughts, these behaviors, these desires outside of neoliberalism? In other words, like, is there something about the way Black people and Blackness is operating in this space that cannot wholly be defined or understood or explained by neoliberalism? And that was a huge, that her telling me that or asking me these questions was helpful, because I felt like it freed me to think about alternative ways of thinking about how Black people were relating to space and moving through space. That said, I do think that there is something important about neoliberalism in terms of the kinds of quote unquote solutions that are offered to food inequities. And I think it's a question that many food scholars are grappling with right now, which is there is this tension between certainly wanting everyone's food needs to be met, and the kind of nonprofit industrial complex funding tied to these measurable, all these things that really aren't about addressing the state's woefully inadequate way of caring for the needs of its citizens, and more like this other industry that has developed in response to food inequities. So, yeah, I think that there is a way that I can now see, now that the book is out and I'm not writing it anymore, I can now see how not writing about these communities solely in terms of neoliberalism opens up possibilities for us to kind of see people's desires more fully, and not just kind of create a new market for how to deal with them.
Yeah, because it gets at that tension of like the individual and the collective, because the people you're talking about, they're talking about like collective uplift and resistance. They recognize inequality, but also take it upon themselves. I really appreciated that sort of complex idea of self-reliance. That's definitely different.
And I was very like, the other thing about, I was actually, the self-reliance piece of the book, which I think is obviously a really big piece of the book, is also the one that I was, and probably still am in some sense, most nervous about, right? Because I have thought about how self-reliance has been taken up as a national value. And I think that's complicated. And I think that there are so many conceptions of the self, that self-reliance could easily be read in so many different ways. So I just say that, say I appreciate you like offering the commentary that you have already on the self-reliance piece.
Yeah. And then you talk just kind of picking up on what you said about solutions. So it appears, you know, from the book, from chapter one, where you lay out these, you know, the historical processes, it appears that, you know, supermarkets are thought to be maybe the solutions to some of the problems, but they're also part of the problem as well. And so at the end of the book, in the conclusion and the last couple chapters, you talk about, you know, self-reliance, not just as this lived experience, but as a blueprint for a possible future. And you talk about the community garden and maybe like Black co-ops as well. Like you talked about a Black co-op in North Carolina. And so I was just wondering if you can talk about how you're thinking about, just kind of expand on what you just said, but the solutions, maybe the one that the community garden in the book, where I was really impressed by the particular gentleman who you were talking to, who you opened up his apartment and he had all of these plants in it. And then he, you know, was also responsible for the garden, and you see this transfer of knowledge to teach young people how to garden. And so just what you think about that, or, you know, or whatever, or the co-op, in moving forward with, you say food in the context of Black liberation. So.
Yeah, no, these are great questions. And as you probably see in the conclusion, like I offer these examples of spaces for us to think about possibilities. And I'm also like, I am very clear that I do not have the solutions or the answers to these questions, and that I don't want to, right? And part of the reason I don't want to is because I think that kind of furthers this idea that there is an expert who could spend however many years I spent in the field, and then therefore, like, I can tell people what they want and what they need. So I want to mention a couple of things. One of my favorite academic articles is Catherine McKittrick's Plantation Futures. And one of the reasons I love that is I think it is a great demonstration of this refusal to have all the answers, but at the same time, demonstrate the ways that we historically have always had these, what she calls secretive histories, that emerge. And these are like these mini pockets of spaces that where people dream, where they resist, where they create these other possibilities. And she's using Sylvia Winter as a, Sylvia Winter's essay on the plot as an example. And so for me, that chapter about the garden, I love talking about that chapter so much because that's my version of the plot, right? Like that's my version of this kind of space that is breeding possibility no matter how much precarity is happening around the outside, right? But what people mostly want when they ask about solutions is a one size fit all or some grand narrative about solutions. And I'm wholly in a lot of ways, I am wholly against these grand narratives. So I look at this garden sometimes that I talk about as a little garden that could, as an example of the kinds of work we should be looking for, this localized work that comes out of people being together, thinking together, creating together. And not that someone decided by running a bunch of numbers on a computer and decided, oh, this community has enough percentage of XYZ, so let's just prop a supermarket there. So there's that. And then the second thing I want to mention, because for anyone listening to this podcast who might be interested in food and identify as Black, I work with the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, and I proudly co-chair what we call the Blackademics, which is a group of Black researchers who are interested in food, who are supporting the National Black Food and Justice Alliance in its goals toward understanding the threats to Black land and Black food, but then also supporting organizations who are doing work in different cities across the country. I personally, working within groups of people sometimes can be challenging, right? And so what I have learned with working with the Alliance is that there is something really beautiful about people struggling toward finding answers together. And that might sound cheesy, but like, it has really been a pleasure to think through, all right, now I have worked on this book about, I've laid out the problems and all of this, and now what? And I do look a lot to community workers, cultural workers, community activists for the so what part.
Yeah, and so wondering if you could talk about, I think, so I wanted to move to how, to you kind of doing the research. And I was wondering, and you talk about how people perceived you when you were in the field. And you mentioned that one of the ways people identified you was as someone who could tell them how to eat healthy or healthily. So talking about, you know, solutions, it seemed like people may have possibly thought that you had certain either solutions or they had different perceptions of you, of what you were interested in. And so I was just wondering if you could talk about how people perceived you and how you managed the perceptions of people that people had about you.
I am not sure that I always managed it well, but so, you know, I got asked to do like healthy eating demonstrations with children more than once. There were times where I wanted to just talk to people about, and I would always say, we could start where you want to start. And people, you know, would immediately start thinking, talking about like, the healthiness of the food that they were eating, which was a signal to me that like, oh, you think that there's one thing that I want to hear and there's not. So it was difficult because it was difficult and sometimes it was actually painful because I would be thinking about all the ways that Black people are made to feel inferior or made to feel like there's something inherently wrong with the way that we do things or the way we eat or whatever. And I didn't want people to feel like they had to perform for me. And then the reality is that even though I'm a Black woman, there is also, I was also researching. And so that researcher identity came into play a lot, right? And then I was also an outsider. I wasn't from Deanwood, not even from Washington, D.C. And so I think it just took some time, which is one of the blessings of doing ethnographic research. You get time to be with people, and that kind of softens those barriers a little bit. But also, I think another important thing about how people perceive me, you know, I read as young. I think that that was something that factored into people being willing to talk to me. I also am cisgendered and read as hetero. And I think that that's why that influenced how and why people were willing to talk to me. And, you know, I just mentioned those things because they were so. It wasn't so simple that like, hey, I'm a Black woman, this grants me access. Certainly, I think on some levels that is absolutely true. But then there were these other things around like, you know, my self-presentation, all of those things, I think, open doors where if someone else were coming to do the exact same research with the exact same questions, it may not have turned out the same way for them.
Mm-hmm. And I also appreciated the variety of methods you employ to answer your research questions. You used archival research, interviews, participant observations, and you did a survey. And I was wondering, and so you kind of touched on this earlier, but so you bring all these methods, you know, to bear in interrogating these problems. And I was just wondering if you could talk generally about the research that you did, but also, and you sort of answered this, because I was really interested in your use of the Ruth Ann Overbeck papers, and how, you know, you included these oral histories. And my question was going to be, were you aware of this collection, and that they had these oral histories from Dean Wood residents before you started? And then also your interviews, you mentioned you kind of let people start where they wanted to. Did you sort of tell them, I'm studying food, you know, you can start where you want? Or how did you sort of prompt them? I'm just wondering how you prompted them.
Yeah, these are great questions. As far as the Overbeck papers, I'm going to say this because for any researcher, especially if you're a grad student out there, this is important. You should always read the footnotes. I found those papers in a footnote to something I was reading. I did not know they existed. I wasn't looking for them. I was just reading like a historical, a chapter about the history of DC. And I looked at the footnotes and there was a footnote to her papers. And then I go, you know, over to GW and there they are, these typed transcripts of these oral histories that she had done. And I was like, man, this is a jackpot. So that was a beautiful find. Let's see how, in terms of interviewing people, I'm a little bit of a hodgepodge kind of interviewer and ethnographer, in the sense that I really truly believe that most people, when I interview them, will answer the kinds of questions that I have without me having to like go in order from question 1 to 10. So often when I would meet with people, you know, we would introduce ourselves, we'd spend some time talking. I always mentioned my background growing up in a small town. For some reason, that made people feel very comfortable. And we would chat for a bit, and then I'd just be like, you know, I have things that I want to know, but I feel really comfortable and confident that we'll get to all of those things. But I just want to start wherever you want to start. That almost always worked. The other strategy that I had, which I learned from one of my professors at AU who does digital storytelling, Nina Shapiro Pearl, I did not, she actually, when I was in the process of doing research, she modeled digital storytelling for me and did an interview with me where I was telling her my food story. And so I used these strategies with people who were kind of a little bit shyer, right? I would ask a question about like their favorite food memory, or I would ask a question around like, well, who did the cooking when you were growing up? That question would generate all kinds of responses. So just whatever felt like would make someone feel comfortable in the moment. And I have to credit, you know, there's a lot of good stuff out there about ethnography and interviewing, but it really was reading Zora Neale Hurston's account in Dust Tracks on the Road about going back home to Florida doing research, and how these, even though this is like community that she knew and, you know, people were very reluctant to talk to her. And she had this moment where she realized it's because she came speaking Bardenese or basically came with the language from the university rather than just showing up as someone who could just talk to people. That, I mean, that really influenced me. And that's how I try to show up, just as a person that someone can talk to. And I happen to have.
Thank you. That was great. Like, you have a lot of tips, so I love that. I'm gonna now go back and reread Dust Tracks because I want to like look at that moment. So this is the second to last question. I was wondering if you could talk about going from dissertation to book. Like, what did that consist of? Was there a lot of follow up research or any like? Sounds, you said you're interested in self-reliance from the beginning. So was there any significant reframing or anything like that that you had to do? Or so what was that process sort of like for you?
Yeah, these are great questions. I did do follow-up research. So in the follow-up research is where I did the survey. I really wanted to know, like, if there were broader trends beyond just like the hyper focus that I had in Dean Woods. I broadened it out towards seven. I did follow-up interviews with people. I spent a lot more time in Dean Wood. So that was on the research part. So I spent like another year doing some more field work. But on the theoretical side, when I did the dissertation, self-reliance was there, but it wasn't there. So on the theoretical side, I reframed for the book project, I reframed the analysis with self-reliance as the connecting thread across the book. And that was very cool. I really enjoyed that kind of process of thinking about what actually connects these chapters, what is at the heart of what I'm trying to say. I did some rewriting and then I added a couple of new chapters, took out some things that I had written in the dissertation. I think for anyone who's listening, who's trying to go from dissertation to book, the biggest advice that I would give is don't try to do it alone. And the reason that I say that is we spend all those hours writing a dissertation, and a lot of it really is alone. Some of what we write in the dissertation is probably really good. Some of it may not be. So when we get back, we go back and we look at this document that we created, a whole lot of our self-worth might be tied up in that document. We could talk about whether or not it should be. I think it shouldn't. But the point is that, like, having other people be able to go through the dissertation with you, even if they're just reading chapters, is super helpful. So I had a friend whose book, Black in Place, Brandi Thompson Summers, she's a sociologist. We were writing our books at the same time, and we just happened to have met when we were starting the book process, and we read each other's work. We would call each other, talk through chapters, ask each other questions, and we would record these calls. And that was super duper helpful to not go through this alone. I also would send things out to other people to read. The last piece of thing I would say about going from dissertation to book is that I had a lot of encouragement and freedom with my dissertation committee. And even still, I was producing a document that would get me my degree. For some of us, when we're writing our first book, we're not trying to get a degree, but we're trying to get tenure. And so you've got that in the back of your mind, or your whatever that thing could be. And I would just encourage people to really think about how, whether we want it to be or not, for many of us, the first book is our introduction into the scholarly world. And it changes things. And so you want to write a book that you're proud of, and you want to write a book that you feel like is somewhat of a, at least somewhat of a reflection of the kinds of things that you're interested in. So different people's processes are different. I can share that my process was relatively quick. So I had done additional field work. I got a book contract, I think in 2016. Book contract in 2016. Submitted full version of the book in 2017. Got comments and submitted the final version of the book the following year in January. So it was quick. So I think, but everybody's process looks very different. Yeah,
that's great advice as I also revise my book and everything like that. So just to close the interview, I was wondering what you're working on next, or what you're future projects are going to be after the book.
Cool, man. So I should plug that Hannah Garth and I have an edited collection that will be out next fall called Black Food Matters. So I'm really excited about that. We were able to, one of the things that happens in food studies, even critical food studies, is there's a lot of writing about a progressive West, sometimes an East Coast, and very little writing about the South. So we were able to bring together 13 chapters, many of which are rooted in the U.S. South, that deal with questions around Blackness, knowledge production, and food. So that's coming out next year. I haven't quite figured out how, but I would really love to continue doing some of the urban food work that I'm doing. So far, like, I've shifted most of my focus in terms of the food access stuff to more of the working collectively with other people. But I want to think through questions around space, gentrification, and food, and I haven't quite figured out what that's going to look like. And then finally, I have a project that I'm just starting on agriculture and prisons that is based so far in my mind, based in East Texas, and thinking through questions of how we think about incarceration and confinement on the one hand. And I'm really curious about how food becomes a link between the carceral state and the everyday, and quite literally using incarceration as a way to trace the way food produced in prisons gets into urban spaces or gets into our everyday spaces.
Great. So we'll look forward to that. That also sounds very timely, the focus on incarceration and the carceral state. So thank you so much. Dr. Reese is the author of Black Food Geographies, Race, Self-Reliance, and Food Access in Washington, D.C. So thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks for talking about it with us today.
Thank you for having me, Reagan. I appreciate it.